If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Rakuten.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of What Most People Think, and I'm going to get straight into my fantastic guest for today, because obviously recently with all the, you know, starting with the Charlie Kirk murder, then all the rancor online, it reminded me that once upon a time we had a desire to get outside of our echo chambers, right? There was a brief period where we were like, let's talk to other people and find out what other people think. It turns out most people really don't want to do that whatsoever. They want to just kind of like migrate to their own social media platform where everyone agrees. So I thought, who do we need? In these troubled times, I reached out for the political balance bat phone and I called Tom Walker, aka Jonathan Pye, and he picked up that call. How are you, mate?
I'm very, very well. Thanks for having me on your show again. Always a pleasure.
You know what else made me think of you? It was that you did an excellent video online in response to the responses, you know, like the Charlie Kirk thing and then the subsequent and what it says about left and right. And I'm sure that you got no push. Because, I mean, you did what I think is the only sensible thing to do at this time, is you had an absolute pop at both sides.
Yeah, yeah. An element of balance whilst calling for a return to civil political discourse whilst also standing up for free speech. Who knew that could be controversial? But what was lovely about it was this video called The Death of Discourse. And you could argue it was a bit fence city, but I had a pop at everyone. And then the responses were either you are a far-right stooge or you are a loony lefty and you are to blame for Charlie Kirk's death. So it was sort of, it's nice when you're pissing everyone off. I think that pie at his best. He's cooked at that point.
I think this is where you and I probably have some shared experience at the moment of wanting to just call out bollocks from all sides. So I would say to people that we'll be unpacking the Jonathan Pye video. So you know, have a pause now and watch it and it'll get you nice and prepped for that. I have had some criticism on the show, Tom, that I don't talk about the Lib Dems, and that is because there's nothing to say ever about the Lib Dems. There's just nothing to say.
Can I just say, I read your email yesterday saying what we were going to talk about, and I'd forgotten that we were going to be talking about the Lib Dems. That's how much, even in an email going, let's discuss the Lib Dems, it went in and then out.
They had their party conference. And,
Did they? I've got no idea.
You're right. They could have saved a lot of money by just doing a few AI images of Ed Davey falling off of stuff. A couple of blokes in a cardigan, some sandals, some craft beer.
Yeah,
some roll-ups.
Yeah,
and there you go. There's a Lib Dem party conference. But there was a big YouGov poll, which is sort of actually, it's quite funny, really. After 14 months of the Lib Dems winning like 71 seats, it's finally occurred to YouGov to think, what do people think about the Lib Dems? It's like a whole year and a bit of no one giving a shit. And they've done this big poll. So we're going to be digging into the results of that. And in the Patreon only, this is a bit of a left field one. I mean, I'm generally sort of keeping an eye on AI in various different ways. But there's a company who are using info and video and photos of dead relatives, to create a sort of AI version of your dear departed loved one. So we'll be talking about what an absolute psychological clusterfuck that might be. New patrons. I'm a bit choked up, actually, Tom. I've changed the podcast platform this is on. I now pay for the production facilities of our excellent producer, Will. And since I said that, new people have joined, you know, support the podcast. I mean, it's just getting support in life, you know.
They're not supporting the podcast. They're just supporting Will. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, I suppose there is that. Oh, yeah, Will needs to become a character in this against his... I haven't really mentioned Will much, but Will's a top bloke. And, yeah, I was delighted to continue our working relationship, but people are pitching in. We've got new patrons. We've got another one even since Friday's show, and his name is William Bright. William Bright.
It sounds like he's the sort of person that would invent something, but in the Victorian era.
Well, but something, you know, like there was that period of mad science. I can't remember if it was the Victorians where they just like were trying to extract sunlight from cucumbers and shit.
Yeah.
They were just going nuts with it.
Or what is it when you like sew two different animals together? It's that sort of thing. Yeah.
He was briefly celebrated. You know, when you find out these weird things from history that like a certain playwright was the absolute shit for about 5 years, but none of their work has withstood the test of time. The other thing about William Bright as well is that for stag do's, he's Mr. Bright. So just when you're drunk, you just get a bit of that and then you make him stand up and just pour a pint on his face or something equally humiliating.
I'll go more with a Victorian inventor than a stag do. You know, I don't think he'd enjoy being covered in beer. And I imagine he drinks bitter. So if you are going to throw a pint at him.
The inventor, William Bright. But maybe he had like a problem and he was sometimes found in the gin palaces of Dulwich.
Who wasn't in that time? You know, it's a good night out.
It must have been great. It must have been great to get off your face in the Victorian era, because like there was so like little diversity in your experience of life. To drink a shitload of gin or take some opium must have been fucking mental.
But totally normal. I read this amazing book by Bruce Robinson, who wrote With Nail and I, but he tries to solve who the Jack the Ripper was. And it's an amazing book. It's a doorstep, but it's amazing. But when one of the opening chapters, he describes Victorian Britain and how you know, a gentleman in a top hat and a cape could walk through the slums, buy a boy to beat. Honest to God, they had rooms where you could beat a boy. And the way he describes it is like, if you were known to beat a boy, you wouldn't exactly be ostracized from society, but there might be a few mutters at the gentleman's club.
Yeah, he's not being as discreet with his boy beating as he might once have been.
As he might. He's a bad egg. But I could highly recommend that book if you've got 6 months to read a very detailed look at.
Is it called?
It's called They All Love Jack, I think.
I think, just being as basic as I am, that he should have called it Shit-Faced Victorians. That would have been like the
title. Yeah, Victorians on the Skag. Yes. Yeah.
That would have been like the Horrible Histories type approach. But welcome, William Brighton. If you want to support the Patreon, remember you get the podcast early, ad-free, and with bonus content. And this week, it's the week where we'll do the Patreon-only episode. So there'll be no breaking news episode. But if you want your second fix, then join. Go to Patreon, find either type in Jeff Norcott or What Most People Think, and you can join up. Our super patron, David Demain. Now, we were talking with Jacob Hawley. By the way, a fact check on Jacob Hawley from last week's episode. He was bemoaning, in a very sort of Reform Party way, the lack of chip shops in Brighton. I think that he was subtly being intolerant there.
Well, they've all turned into Turkish barbers, haven't they? It's disgusting.
I mean, look, he didn't say that.
But it was implied. It was implied.
Yeah. But what he was saying, that there were none on the walk from this, because he says he likes getting chips on the way home from doing a gig in Brighton. He said there were no chippies on the way from the gig to the station. And then people immediately took to Twitter. That's a great phrase, isn't it? People took to Twitter to fact check him. So I just thank you for pointing out his lies. I have referred him to Ofcom.
Well, he lied because there are fish and chip shops on.
There are fish and chip shops.
Right, okay.
This is the kind of thing Richard Tice has picked up on it. It's now doing the rounds.
And also the age we live in, you have something in your pocket where you can type in fish and chip shops near me.
Yes.
And it will be 95% accurate. Come on, mate. Sort yourself
out. This thing with these right wingers like Jacob, you know. but we were talking about the fact that if there were fancy, you know, the ones in London are quite fancy, and how I would pay like 20 quid for cotton chips if they said they had four different kinds of vinegar. I would go, wow, four. Yeah. I never knew there were four. Yeah. And David Demain, our super patron who keeps an eye on the show from previous weeks, says that the two most common vinegars are the traditional malt vinegar and something called non-brewed condiment. The latter is made from acetic acid with flavouring that mimics malt vinegar. It's cheaper than malt. White vinegar is also used, especially in Scottish chippies. And then David Domain just recommends some chippies. The Weatherby Whaler franchise, which can be found in Wakefield, York, Pudsey, Guiseley, Tadcaster, and of course Weatherby. I mean, at least four of those places sound made
Today's show is sponsored by the British Council of Fish and Chips. I always like the phrase vinegar tits. I just think it's such a great phrase.
Where does it come from? Is that a you phrase?
I don't know, but it would always be sort of like, I always imagine it's sort of what my mum would call sort of a haughty Victorian sort of nanny or something. You go, all right, vinegar tits.
Yeah, but,
you know, and I love the fact I'm blaming my mum on that. So it's sort of trying not to sound too misogynistic.
Not to own it. I mean, like, it's maybe the family of sugar tits. It's sugar tits is nice. If you're vinegar tits.
Sugar tits is a great for sugar tits and vinegar tits. I think they should, we should have a moratorium for that from woke culture. We should be allowed to do that.
Yeah, bring back sugar tits.
And vinegar tits.
David said that Peter Mandelson has been forced out of office three times now. In 1998, he was forced into his first government resignation when it was revealed he received a secret loan of nearly 400 grand from his ministerial colleague, Geoffrey Robinson. I mean, with inflation, that's a lot of money as a secret loan. He later returned to the Blair government only to quit in January 2001 over allegations of misconduct over a passport application for the Hinduja brothers. Although an inquiry later cleared him of wrongdoing. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that it cleared him of wrongdoing. But what it does remind us is Peter Manson loves rich blokes, absolutely loves rich blokes.
And it also reminds us that Keir Starmer is a superb judge of character.
Brilliant.
And foresight. Because, I mean, no one saw this little thing happening.
How could you blame him, for bringing back the twice sacked Prince of Darkness? You know, sometimes these things just sideswipe you. And just finally from David Domain, we talk about the word Cassandra, where that comes from. Cassandra is somebody who makes doom-laden predictions which are to be disbelieved. The original Cassandra was a Trojan princess in Greek mythology. She was awarded the gift of prophecy by Apollo, albeit cursed so that no one would ever believe her predictions. So was Cassandra right about stuff, but just discredited, basically?
This is definitely not my area of expertise. What are we talking here? Sort of ancient
Greek mythology. Well, what I was saying in the break
is you may as well be talking to me about football right now.
Well, I've been told some facts and I still don't know. This is how thick I am.
Right.
I mean, I would say that given, you know, one thing I was saying, when you look at Pandora, Cassandra and Eve, women in mythology and history tend to get blamed for stuff. So let's do that again and say that Cassandra was wrong and it's right that she's gone down in infamy.
Probably.
What most people think.
The thank you and the fuck you. Right, the first free tour shows. I did the first free tour shows last week. Thursday night in Tring. What a crowd there. I mean, Jesus Christ. I don't know if you guys were on mushrooms or something, but that was amazing. Bristol, the Redgrave Theatre was lovely. And then I had a really cool Sunday night crowd last night in Bath. But at Bristol, Tom, I had that amazing sound, which you must get, is the sound, a woman laughing against her better judgment. Isn't that a wonderful sound where you've elicited that reluctant laughter? You've made them into a bad person.
It's the basis of comedy. And I always say this, but I was quite a good pupil at school and I was fairly smart. So the work didn't worry me, but I was sort of fairly naughty. But I sort of got away with it because the key to it was, if you can make the teacher laugh before their face drops and they send you out the room, you've won. You know, so if you can make the teacher laugh despite herself, you have to. And it is the greatest sound in a comedy room when they laugh just before they groan. And you go, I got you. Yeah. I got you. You know.
Yeah. And you go, no, you can't do both. You're not allowed. If you've laughed, then you are fucking complicit.
Yeah. And you agree with everything I've just said on face value.
Yeah, you at least agree with the twisted principle of what I've said. So now we're all complicit. Let's just relax and enjoy ourselves. The fuck you, I think this is going to be a shared fuck you. We were talking about this just before we started recording. This might be controversial, but crisps. I've recently, and this has been like the scales falling from my eyes, that I've had a real reassessment of my relationship with crisps. I have automatically, like many people, ate them for lunch unthinkingly every day. And then just recently, I've gone, do I even like crisps?
Yeah.
Do
I'm with you. And it's not, for me, it's not a lunchtimey thing. It's a pub snack kind of thing. And if I'm having a pub snack, I want a mini cheddar, a bacon fry, what's the fishy one? Not fishy.
Scampi.
Scampi fry. Love a scampi fry. Peanuts, or even those sort of like crispy little weird things that are sort of like Thai crispy things that they do if you're in a posh one.
I know the one.
But a packet of crisps. I was with a mate recently and we were having lunch and it was a sandwich and he opened a packet of crisps and put his crisps in the sandwich and started eating it. And I was like, crisps in a sandwich, really? And he was like, yeah, always. And then everyone around the table was like, are you joking? This is definitely, and this has been an experience that I've never had. And it's a habit that I don't think I'm going to start because I'm too old.
I will get letters, by the way, what most people think, uk@gmail.com. Chris sandwich is a big deal to a lot of people.
It's, yeah, I know. It's just never been part of my, culinary oeuvre.
I mean, there is a level of British cuisine. I think a ketchup sandwich as well.
What, just ketchup?
Yeah.
No, fuck off. No, unless you're a fucking student. Unless you're a student, then, that's fine. I mean, we've all, got home and just had a Dairy-Lee slice because there's no bread. Sometimes you have to do that.
A ketchup sandwich.
No. Ketchup with crisps. And now I'm starting to think,
if you're doing all right for yourself, fine. Yeah, show off a little bit, throw in some crisps. But essentially, living back on the estate, Tom, I don't like to bring it up, but... ketchup sandwiches. But the problem is when you have stuff when you're poor and it's comfort food, you then grow up and still think that's a good idea. But I'm looking at crisps and I'm just saying, is it just a new way of getting salt into my face? And if so, why don't I just cut out the middleman and just start dabbing salt or drinking soy sauce? Okay, right. As I said earlier, following on from Tom's excellent videos, Jonathan Pye, we're going to talk about left versus right. So, as I mentioned in the intro, Jonathan Pye did an excellent video called The Death of Discourse. So I think to kick this off, we'll just play a little clip of that now.
We appear to have entered a new era of political violence, perhaps from both sides, where there is no place for civil discourse and robust argument, but where guns and violence and threats of violence settle the score instead. How the pendulum has swung. It's been a long time coming, but after over a decade of liberal elites' barely concealed hatred for those who don't vote the way we want them to, a decade of eye-wateringly puritanical pearl-clutching and thought crime and cloyingly well-meaning but patronising lectures about identity, a society where opinions are policed, where unsavoury jokes became arrestable offences, the left washed their hands of free speech, gladly handing it to the right, who are now using it as a stick to beat us with, using it to silence everyone on the left by branding us all terrorists. The left have emboldened a right that mops up those left behind and who stray from the very narrow path that is the progressive liberal consensus.
Full of gags, as ever. That is pinging one-liners. It's like Michael McIntyre.
Well, you know what was funny about that video is that among the kind of people either accusing you of being a fascist or a communist, there was quite a lot of Americans going, seriously, is this what counts for journalism in your country?
Well, I'm afraid it does. I mean, you'd be amazed the amount of followers that I'm just like, he speaks more truth than any journalist. Like, I really don't. Or pie for PM, get that a lot. Can you fucking imagine?
No, I mean, the thing is, when I did Question Time the first time, all you have to do on your Question Time debut to get people to say that you should be Prime Minister is just say some really unsubstantiated, easy answer bollocks go, where in my view, the government need to get a grip and sort it out because it's been going on too long. It's like that great Harry Enfield and Paul Whitehouse sketch where the general public, or if you're a comedian on a panel, because you don't have any bosses, you could just say any old shit and get a round of applause. But I think this is a really good video. I think it covered a lot of ground and it had sort of criticisms for left and right. But just sort of unpack your main thinking there. One of the sentences that stood out for me was about the woke zombies. That's a great bit of phrasing.
Yeah. I mean, bear in mind this came out before the Jimmy Kimmel debacle, so it's sort of pre that bit. But I suppose it's essentially, about the fact that we were so quick when he came out, and there, I'm sure there are plenty of listeners who won't recognise this behaviour, but we all went online to try and find out who this killer was, and in the hope that he was on the other side, and therefore we would win the argument, which sort of tells you all you need to know, really. Now post Kimmel, it's sort of now this added layer of the hypocrisy of kind of what happened there. But everyone, I suppose what's interesting as well, the left have spent the last decade sort of being very cancelly, and the right, and I've agreed with them on this, have been going, freedom of speech is really important, even for people to say nasty things you don't agree with. And the tables have suddenly shifted, and suddenly lefties that have been calling me out for being pro-free speech as some sort of right-wing useful idiot for the right are now going, oh my God, no, free speech is really important because Jimmy Kimmel just got cancelled, and it's the right that are suddenly getting a bit cancelly and a bit punchy and a bit sensitive. It's kind of, I really thought the right was right about this, but it turns out they're just as, they were just using it as a stick to beat us with rather than actually meaning it. Because it doesn't matter what side of the fence you are, free speech, it's such a trope, but it's worth repeating, is for not just people you like, but for people you fundamentally disagree with. It's so sort of obvious.
But it's sort of tactical. That's what you realise. It's not all the left and all the right, but certainly large parts of the online left and online right. It's very tactical, and you know, like the right, there's a part of the right that weren't actually against it. They were just like, oh, that looks like fun. I wish I could do that. I wish I could be the one doing the cancelling. And, you know, I think you rightly as well in your video criticised Donald Trump's reaction, like his ability to bring it back to himself. Actually,
well, I think that's the point as well, is if you look at, say, for example, the reason Jimmy Kimmel got fired, and there are two or three reasons, things that he said that could have been the case. But the bit that I think got him into trouble is saying, is implying, well, pretty much explicitly saying that the killer is probably a MAGA Republican, right? And that's demonstrably not true. But so them trying to sort of cancel Jimmy for that and saying how appalling that was would hold a bit more truck if Donald Trump hadn't gone out like 10 minutes after Charlie Kirk's death, before the guy was in custody, before we knew who did it, blaming this on, you know, the far left. And also this idea that Jimmy Kimmel's been fired for lying on air, which again, you could kind of go, yeah, that does, he did definitely say that this killer is probably a MAGA Republican. But that again would hold some truck if, you know, how many times has Trump lied down the barrel of the camera live on television? So there's sort of that double standard hypocrisy, you know.
Yeah, John Stewart did a really good monologue for people. People want to look at that, and he kind of points out, you know, like Trump spoke about all the accusations of fascism and far right, kind of fanning the flames of the hatred. But then they just showed a montage of all the times that he's accused his opponents of being those things. One thing I did think was interesting was that you sort of laid in your video, like, the blame for some of what the right has become at the feet of the left. You know, we were talking about hysterical reactions to
you know, this cancel culture, this feeling that you can't say things that you feel, this idea that, you know, we've had certainly here, you know, if you're thinking of voting Brexit, you must be a far right anti-immigration asshole. Even if you do think that immigration, you know, is out of control and needs some, you know, serious changes in the way we approach it, that you must be a right wing asshole, and pushing people kind of to the right in that regard, and that the left have to take some responsibility for creating an atmosphere where you're either with us or you're against us. You know, both sides are to blame for that, but the left do have to take some responsibility for the, you know, the death of discourse. The right have to take some responsibility for that as well. But and also, you know, the fact that Charlie Kirk got shot, and a lot of, you know, it's really difficult to take a sample of the morality of humanity by looking at Twitter, because you know,
but I mean, it's probably the worst place
it's
for it,
the worst place to go. But a lot of people, you know, really seriously having a hop and a skip over this guy that's dying, and then suddenly the worst thing in the world is, because you know, let's be clear about this, a guy losing his nightly chat show because of things he said pales in comparison to a man losing his life because of things that we've said. And I think we do need a bit of perspective there. A guy was fucking shot. Just because I don't didn't agree with him. You know, I like Jimmy Kimmel and I didn't like Charlie Kirk, but that doesn't mean that Charlie Kirk's death is far more horrific an act to a, you know, a millionaire losing.
The interesting thing, Tom, is that you're having to say things, right, that in a weird way, because of the febrile nature of discourse, sound radical and sound like a sort of philosophical shot across the bows. But it's fucking obvious. It's saying, like, the cancellation of a chat show, while bad, is not equivalent to a man getting shot in public for his views.
I would add a caveat to that, though, is both of those incidents, one, you know, incalculably more horrific than the other, but both of those incidents do have far-reaching implications for the way discourse is dealt with, the way that, you know, people do kill people for things that they've said, but also the fact that the administration, which, you know, in his inauguration speech, Trump said, "I am going to bring back free speech into the public arena, specifically on television." He said it in his inauguration speech, and now they're putting pressure on, you know, "We will take away your license if you do not spend a lot more time kissing Trump's ass."
It's a wider ecosystem where it wasn't specifically that Donald Trump said this show must be cancelled, because, you know, there were late night talk show hosts that also criticised Trump's. But the mistake that Kimmel made factually just opened the gates for them, for the affiliates. So it was a whole realm of pressure that came to bear, really.
But also, and if you look at that, one of the things that Kimmel got in trouble for is saying that the MAGA administration is using Charlie Kirk's death to score political points. I haven't seen very much that contradicts that statement, because by virtue of him getting cancelled for saying it, it's like you're actually just proving the point that, of course, they're scoring political points.
But there's just one thing I wanted to say about Trump. You know, if people want to push back on the idea that he would weaponize this, in the vigil, right, that happened in this stadium over the weekend for Charlie Kirk, and it was quite a funny moment, but also instructive, is when he talks about Charlie Kirk, his attitude to the people that he disagrees with. It's quite revealing what he says. So we'll just play the clip now.
"He did not hate his opponents. He wanted the best for them. That's where I disagreed with Charlie. I hate my opponent, and I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry. I am sorry, Erica. But now Erica can talk to me and the whole group, and maybe they can convince me that that's not right, but I can't stand my opponent."
So, yeah, basically what he said is that Charlie always said, you know, you should respect your opponents and want the best of them. And he's like, basically, "No, I don't want that." I mean, he literally stands.
He says, "I hate them. I hate my opponents," is what
he said.
I mean,
it's quite funny because you go, how the fuck do you fight against that when a bloke's willing to just go out and go, "Nah, not me, mate. Fucking hate those bastards."
Also, this was 24 hours, maybe 48 hours after Charlie Kirk's death. He was asked on a Fox News interview, how are you going to try and bring the country together after this? And he said, "I couldn't care less." Well, you've sort of got to admire his balls there, but he doesn't care less, and that is frightening. And you could in a way say, look, it's 24, 48 hours after a colleague or a close friend or a close supporter of his has died. You can understand that he might be angry, but he's the president of the United States, for fuck's sake. It's like, and also the other thing that Jimmy Kimmel sort of did a joke about is he's asked, "How are you holding up, Mr. President? You know, you've just lost a friend." "Yeah, I'm doing really well because we're building a ballroom." He just talks about building his ballroom. So, and you could argue that Jimmy Kimmel bringing that up is tasteless, but you go, but it's no more tasteless than what Donald Trump just actually did.
What most people think.
Just a couple more general points about left versus right. We are on you know, slightly different sides of the divide. What do you think it's more fun to be? Is it more fun to be a left winger or a right winger? Because it's strange, because there's that phrase. Have you heard of this phrase, protest with the left, party with the right? Have you heard of that one? You know, if there's ever
that does make sense. I've seen it happen in my sort of 10 years of doing pie, 10 fucking years, 10 years yesterday since I put my first video out. I've lost my train of thought because I was talking about me.
It seemed what happened was you started off celebrating something, but then felt old, and then got overtaken by a sense of ennui.
In the 10 years that I've been doing this, it's definitely cooler to be right wing, and the kids are. It's because that prescribed liberal norm that was the culture war was won whilst we were losing elections left, right, and centre. The left were winning the culture war, and therefore it was far more rock and roll to be right wing. And now it's much more fun to be right wing because they seem to be, for want of a better phrase, winning the argument. I think the culture war is swinging back. It's not just politically, but the culture is swinging to the right. Whereas it used to be, I'm sure, in like the 60s and 70s, it was much more cooler to be left wing.
Oh, yeah. You could pretend to be one of those hippie blokes pretending to be all cool, but actually secretly a massive alpha that just wanted to shag loads of women.
Yeah.
I still think they exist. I would say that it is becoming less fun to be on the right unless you're at the further ends of the right, because in its attempts to emulate the woke left, the right is now starting to cannibalize itself, where people can't have enough ideological purity. So I think that the era of the kind of banter era of the right, of having a laugh, I do think we're now in the death rattles of that.
Well, there is that thing of the woke right that I'm sure we could talk about. But what is interesting, when we both kind of fucking started, really, again, sort of 10 years ago, you've probably been doing it a bit longer than me. I remember we did an interview together and it was like this: here's a right-wing comedian, here's a left-wing comedian, and you're right of centre, I'm left of centre. And that seemed like a big enough gap for that to become an interesting, potentially interesting article. We're seen by a lot of people as essentially the same because we're near the center line, near that sort of area of reasonableness and sort of give and take. And that oddly seems extreme now that we're sort of the fucking fence sitters, you fucking, you know.
Pound on each horse, is it? You're doing each way bet on the, you're doing each way bet on the boat race, would you? Yeah, it's like that. You go, no, that's just how my brain works. It's sometimes I argue with myself. Sometimes I feel differently. But then also, like, it is hilarious, like, with people kind of like shooting past you on the Overton window. But yeah, well, you know a second ago how you suddenly felt a sense of ennui for feeling old. I'm just feeling a sense of ennui for realizing that we've bit by bit become sort of centrist dads. Okay, we're just going to do a quick hype. The new tour dates went up. I mentioned it in Friday's show, and there are dates in. Off the top of my head, there are new dates in London. There's a date in London on the 29th of November that's just gone on sale. We've got Chorley, we've got Folkestone, we've got Solihull, we've got Coventry. The thing is, right, Tom, I don't think I'm popular enough to just stick like you a big venue in the middle of a city and say, you come here. Mine is very much like the Meals on Wheels of comedy, where I have to literally go to where fucking everybody is. I will deliver that comedy to your door. Do you know what I mean? That might be the next tour, the door-to-door tour.
Yeah. Just go to people's living rooms. I mean, the only reason I try and play big venues is to get the tour over and done with as quickly as possible. Because
I would if I could, but I can't. Have you got, you said last time that you were sort of like Indiana Jones rolling under that thing and grabbing your hat where we just about had a Labour government. So what's your, looking forward, is the new tour starting to come together?
It is, actually. Thanks for asking. I essentially have taken the summer off, right? After I delivered the last series of the podcast for the BBC thing, and I just thought, you know, I just need three or four months off where I was starting to not enjoy it again, right? And it's been a really good thing because I've come back in September, you go, right, let's put the pie hat back on, and I've got an idea for my next tour, and I think I'm going to book it in for next year, and I'm ready to get rolling, you know. And also enough time has passed since I told people to vote Labour for me to kind of go, right, I really now feel that there's enough time has passed for me to start getting my eye in with the present administration. It just felt a little bit crass to do it 2 months after I've... But he's been going long enough and he really is fucking dog shit that I feel like... Yeah. Come on, let's go.
Good. Well, is that what most people think exclusive there?
It is. I have not booked the tour in yet. My promoter is looking at venues, but I think stuff will be on sale before Christmas.
Okay, so join up to whatever mailing list or the kind of Jonathan Pye stuff that you need for that. We're talking Lib Dems now. That's right.
Booyakasha. Yeah. Yes. Now we're going to get spicy. Yeah.
Let's get cancelled. they had their conference at the weekend, and Ed Davey, he's a bit out of stunts now, so he arrived with a marching band. And I would say, like, it sort of reminded you that since the election, Banter Ed hasn't really made an appearance in the Commons itself, but it was all banner. It was all falling off stuff. It was all like middle-aged divorced dad on the set of Total Wipeout. And then all of a sudden the guy gets in the Commons, most serious fucking solemn guy you've ever met in your life. I'm going to say it, Tom Walker, that his banter promise is like the numbers on the side of the bus. It is the great unfulfilled promise of British policy. We were sold a fucking lie.
We were.
Ed Davey was going to make us laugh every day, and we voted in numbers. And what has he done that's funny since?
I think he's played a good long game, you know. I think the last election for the Lib Dems was like, this is sink or swim. You know, we could have a really good night, or we could just be fucking flattened once again. And him just whoring himself out for just funny headlines, you know, they did pretty well. But actually, he's sort of starting to turn into quite a decent parliamentarian, right? He does ask. And also, I think they let's see how well we do, and then we'll find what we stand for once we've sort of done all right at the election. And they seem sort of this, again, left of centre, but a voice where, you know, what an opposition can do, like poke the bits that sort of get to the nub of it. So I think he's doing really well. And I think it must be frustrating that Mr. Farage, obviously with his three or four MPs, gets all the fucking headlines. And they did really well. And they do have, you know, they've got a proper chunk of MPs in there now. I've sort of been oddly impressed by Ed Davey, another exclusive.
That in its own way is a proper hot take. Impressed by the Lib Dems. You're not something you see much. I mean, what I think is odd is that, you're right, they've got these MPs. They have taken more definable positions on Trump and on Gaza, but they somehow feel less culturally relevant than when they had 15 MPs. They had an identity then, that they were this small band of whittled down failures that got their ass handed to them after showing off by being part of the coalition. And yet with 71 MPs, they don't have as much identity. I think you're right. Like, as on the day that we talk, Reform have made another announcement on immigration. And the left and the right-wing press can't stop just lapping up whatever Reform say. And the other thing about the Lib Dems is when they try to show personality and character, it feels like a group of wacky middle-class people trying to look wacky. Whereas when, say, for example, Andrea Jenkins sung that like weird musical song on stage at Reform, you go, that's who she is. That means she's
a bit really handsome. Is. She just, yeah, she's always wanted to be the lead in her local Amdram, and that's why she went into politics.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, just for the record, I thought she nailed that. I thought she had presence, she had sass, charisma. She wrote that song. It wasn't bad.
But she couldn't remember because she sang the national anthem at the end, didn't she? And she did. And she sang God Save the Queen. She had forgotten that.
No, she was being an ally. She was being a gay ally.
Yeah.
Do you realise what's happened here, Tom? Is we're supposed to be talking about the Lib Dems, and then we said, well, we always end up talking about Reform.
And we ended up
talking about Reform.
That says it all, doesn't it? But yeah, I mean, you know, I've said my bit about Lib Dems. I mean, how long can you talk about them for, really?
Let's throw in some stats here from this YouGov poll, okay? Only 8% of Brits believe that Ed Davey looks like a prime minister in waiting. Now, that's not high, but, you know, it should be said that Kemi Badenoch only has 9% and she's the official opposition.
When you started that sentence, I thought you were going to say something really weird at the end, like Bungle from Rainbow. Only 7% of the thing Ed Davey looked like Bungle from Rainbow. But no, you're quite right. He looked like Prime Minister.
I think there's probably more people that thinks he looks like Bungle from Rainbow fairness.
I don't know. I think I could see him as a actual statesman. I mean, I can certainly see him as Prime Minister over Nigel Farage. Well, I can't. I can see Nigel Farage being our Prime Minister very soon. But I'd take Ed Davey over him, but that should be no surprise to anyone.
Interesting. I've never got a sense of real personality when Ed Davey speaks. He's sort of from that technocratic band of politicians. Like when he stands opposite Starmer, I just feel like their kids go to the same faith school. you know, maybe they go out cycling together. There's just a sort of slightly beige, insipid.
Yeah, but you can imagine, you can at least imagine Ed Davey sort of coaching, you know, the under fives football team.
True.
Or something. Whereas Keir would just sort of, I don't know what he'd help out with, really. He's probably on the sort of the PTA.
The PTA.
Yeah, the PTA.
He just wants, his only conviction, Keir Starmer, is that he should be running things. Beyond that, yeah. There's fuck all going on there.
He should be running things badly. That's what he, yeah.
No, he never said well, in fairness. He just said he should be running them. He never committed. That's very Keir Starmer. He never committed.
To doing it professionally and well with decent judgment. God, no, that was never on the table.
10% of Lib Dem voters think they'd do a bad job in office. That's sort of hilarious, isn't it? People who actually voted for them.
Didn't that happen with everyone that voted Conservative at the last election, though? We know, we've had it demonstrated to us time and time again that you'll do a bad job, but we're voting for you anyway. But there is something quite sad in that statistic. I mean, I voted Labour despite myself. I didn't want Keir Starmer to be Prime Minister. I just didn't want those.
Yeah, it would be objectively mental to actively desire that sort of thing. Here's an interesting one. The percentage of men who do not trust the Lib Dems at all, is much higher than women. It's a real significant statistical difference. 22% of women do not trust the Lib Dems at all.
Having zero trust in someone, like no trust in anyone on anything, is you're essentially going, Ed Davey's a fucking suicide bomber. Yeah. You know, he could just go off at any minute. Don't trust him. Don't go fucking near him.
He's holding
a nail bomb in his fucking backpack.
I do not trust.
But even slightly, not a fucking grain of sand of trust in Ed Davey.
It says in the question, at all. It says, do not trust the Lib Dems at all.
Don't trust him with your kids. Don't trust him with
the economy. Don't trust him with your wife.
The kids or your economy. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like, it's getting on for 40%. That's a really, really high figure. And I was just trying to think, why would it be statistically so much higher than men don't trust the Lib Dems? I think it's because men, no other men that try to seem like nice guys, and we all know what they're up to. That's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, you're just trying to get with my wife. That's what you're trying to do.
Yeah, but also the reason women trust him is like, if he fucking tried it, most women could go, I could fucking have Ed Davey. So that's, if he fucking tried it, I'd like to see him try. So that's why they kind of trust him, because they know he won't.
Okay, well, look, there we go. We've done a bit on the Lib Dems. And the thing about Lib Dems, you would think that we've absolutely slaughtered them in some, you were, you know, reasonably positive, but we slaughtered them in other respects. Thing about Lib Dems, they're just happy to be spoken about. They just feel seen, they feel validated, and now we can ignore them for another 6 months.
But also, if I can offer you a suggestion, Jeff, just edit all of that down a bit, eh? Because you'll lose a lot of...
2 minutes, yeah. I mean, I don't want to lose ad revenue. You're fucking kidding. We'll do a bit more on reform. And put it in afterwards. Most people think. Okay, for everybody else, it will be the end of the show. But for patrons, me and Tom Walker are going to discuss, this is quite a left field one, the idea of, would you resurrect your dead relative as an AI avatar? That is actually one of my favourite patron-only chats, because it was fucking weird and we ended up talking about a holographic version of a dead pet. So if you're interested in that, do go to Patreon and join up. Tom Walker, this left versus right episode, it's good to meet across the no man's land of our mild political differences and somehow find a way.
It was like that football match in World War One, wasn't it? And we just came together.
It was, with the shitty Marks and Spencer's music as well, or whatever that was. So listen, it was great to get the scoop on the exclusive. So do sign up and follow. Have a look at the video, as I say. Go to all Tom's socials as Jonathan Pye. And is there a mailing list? I said mailing list.
There isn't. I should probably set one up. So no, there isn't.
Do not go to the mailing list, because it doesn't fucking exist.
There isn't one.
Okay, but do keep an eye out for tour dates. Thanks very much for being on the show, Tom.
Thank you very much.
And I will be back for the patrons with a patron-only episode later this week, and then back with a main episode for everybody else early next week.